What time is it?
We ask that question all the time. I carry right here a watch. They could call it a look because you just look at it, but they call it a watch because you watch it. But hard as you watch it, you don't see anything happening until you wait about 5 minutes. You look and it's changed position. You can't really see the minute hand move on a small watch. Our entire lives are regulated by time. But what is time? Now, without getting into Einstein's theory, and I'll guarantee you I couldn't get into it very far, even if I tried, time is space, and space is time. Time is measured by distance. In other words, our years are measured by the distance that this Earth travels as it goes around our star, which is called the Sun. And that's 1 year, we say, of four seasons, we say. Of 52 weeks, approximately. But we find out that the way the moon goes around the Earth as the Earth is going around the Sun, and lunations are each monad, 30 days approximately, but it's not really 30 days accurately, so that the sol-lunar calendar that we use is very inaccurate. The Metonic cycle itself was inaccurate, a 19-year time cycle in which the various bodies in our solar system, not in the universe, as was reportedly stated many, many years ago, come into exact conjunction, but even the Metonic cycle is off by just a little bit. And so we regulate everything according to clocks, seconds, hours, days, weeks, months, years, and by an artificial calendar. I found it amazing that even though the Chinese have a completely different calendar, like they have the year of the pig and the year of the rat, you might know, and it starts at different times. The Islamic countries have a completely different calendar. The Hebrews have a different calendar. Our calendar is based upon Pope Gregory III, a Roman Catholic prelate, a pope, who decided to make the adjustments that the scholars in the Vatican at that time presented to him over the Julian calendar that had been in vogue since Julius Caesar. Now, those of you that have access to a PC can do what I've done, and simply get article after article, book-length, encyclopedic articles, and I've got a huge file about the calendar. And you can find out all about it just by tapping into it on a web search engine and get all the information you want. And that's not my purpose here today. But we are on a journey, and that journey is requiring time. We are on a space capsule. Our capsule, this beautiful green Earth, is protected by a mantle of air that burns up thousands of bits of space debris that come hurtling out of space every single day. And just because you only see them at night, it doesn't mean that there are not hundreds, if not thousands, of little pieces of space debris and junk that we call meteorites once they strike the Earth, and meteors if they don't, that are burning up in the Earth's atmosphere or skipping off the Earth's atmosphere and going on out somewhere else into outer space. Every year that we make a journey completely around our star, and that our moon is continually making approximately 12 journeys around the Earth, we age a little bit more. We sleep and we eat and we get up and we go to work and we go through all the various physical necessities and requirements. And I once saw some statistics that put together all of the food and the water and the things that we would consume in the case of a lifetime of approximately 70 years, and they told me it was like a 200 or 300 car train load of chickens and cows and whatever it was, but it would just couldn't believe it, what it takes to keep every human being alive. And of course, that journey is something that has a destination. It had a beginning, and it has a target destination. If you ever got aboard an aircraft and you said to somebody sitting alongside you, where are you going? And if you said, I really don't know. You said, well, but you've got to be going somewhere. Where's the airplane going? Well, I haven't the faintest idea. Well, why are you aboard it? I don't know. But that's the average answer you get from people if you ask a very serious philosophical question, what's this trip all about? What is this journey on this earth all about? Why are you here? My father used to ask by the hundreds of times. What is the purpose of human life? Well, time is something which Almighty God Himself has invented. If you will turn to the very first chapter of the Bible, it talks about a relative term only to man and from man's perspective, because this is God's word to man about man, who he is, why he is, why he was created in the first place, what he is doing here, what's it all about, what is the end of it all, what happens when he dies, why was he made in God's image. God says, in the beginning. Now, to us, everything has a beginning and an ending, whether it's a lifetime, a trip, or a play. Everything has limits to our minds. And so we grow up thinking in terms of rectangles and squares and various geometric designs. Up is not out or away, it is up. And down is not within, it is down. And we cannot divide 100 into thirds, it's impossible. And we cannot deal with the term forever. And we have no concept of from eternity to eternity, means nothing to us. If you go into outer space and you continue on forever and ever and ever, and even a concept of one little cluster of what we think are stars being a galaxy like our Milky Way with maybe 200 billion stars, each of which may have 9, 11, 20, or 100 planets that could someday be habitable, boggles our minds. And so we deal instead with closed, finite terms, like walls and ceilings and floors, and like seconds and minutes and months and years, and like miles or meters. And we learn as children what these measurements of time and distance are. We talk about it all the time. Just a second, they say, when you walk into a store. I'll be right with you. 15 minutes later, here they are. Not a second at all, but I mean, just a second, and 15 minutes later, here they are. Well, it's high time we did such and such. Or it's past time, say the politicians, to do this or that. Or, well, it's about time, says the wife when he finally walks in with a paycheck. And everything revolves around time. Whether you're traveling somewhere, you want to know how fast can you go, how many miles is it, approximately when will you arrive. There are all kinds of philosophical and religious observations about the meaning of time, and there are hundreds of statements in the Bible. If you look up the word time, if you look up the word times, and all the other words that are associated with it, it is just replete through the Bible from the very first chapter to the last. So he said, in the beginning, God, and the word is Elohim, and it means more than one, created the heaven and the earth. That word is bara, B-A-R-A in Hebrew, and it means literally brought into being from nothing. That's why Peter wrote that the things which do appear are made of those things which do not appear, to paraphrase what he said. Now, getting into a little bit of the investigation of matter, I looked up, for example, this morning, was reading a little bit again about the disintegration of U-238 to PB-206, and about Madame Curie and the discovery of radium and thorium and all these various elements in Earth which used to glow in the dark and don't ever wear the kind of a watch that I wore way back years ago where I could look at it under the covers, a greenish glow. That was radioactive. And they began to learn that these are not good things for you to have on your arm. You're getting some radiation from them. Well, they determined, and it ought to prove the existence of God, by the discovery of radioactive material, such as we find in polonium and so on in the making of an atomic bomb, that there are radioactive metals in this earth and that they are gradually emitting energy and they are running down. And they've established tables of the half-life of the period of time through which a radioactive material like uranium-238 will eventually become inert lead. And lead, of course, is the shield that is used to protect men from the rays that bombard their bodies through nuclear energy. And it is a known half-life. But the half-life, if I had a blackboard, is like dividing 100 into thirds. It's half of the material disintegrates over a period of 1,000, whatever it is, I forget the number of years. Then half of the remainder over another period of time. Then half of the remainder over the same period of time. Another half of the remainder until finally you're down to where you can't even see the dot at the end of the page, but it's still going on until eventually it becomes lead. So they proved, essentially, that the Earth is like a giant clock, and it was once wound up. It had a starting point. It had a beginning, and it's gradually running down. The oceans are gradually filling up, and the bays and the estuaries dumping silt. The mountains are gradually eroding down because of animals and freezing and rock slides and mud slides and on and on and on. There is a definite geological physiological, scientific method of proving that the Earth had a beginning, and that it was born at some time, and that the mechanics, the mechanism by which it came into being, for example, orogeny. How did the mountains get formed? Well, if you look at a map of the United States and then go home and take your coverlet and just jump on the bed and push the coverlet ahead of you to the other side of the bed, you'll have a little bit of indication of the map of the United States. Because if you look at the great chain of mountains that begin clear up in the Aleutians and come right on down through Mount McKinley and on down through the Cascades and down through the Sierra Nevadas and right on down through Mexico, right through Central America, all the way through the Andes, the Cordillera del Sur, they call them, and so on, and Aconcagua, 22,000 feet down in Chile, you will see a little bit of our hemispheric part of the Ring of Fire. And it goes all the way around the world, and it's a belt of active volcanoes. If you push that coverlet, what's going to happen right in front of your hands? Big, rumpled, big folds and everything. And behind it, well, be more or less level, but maybe certain areas that are upset a little bit. If you look at the map of the world, the globe, and you see how Africa and the bulge fits right into the part of South America, and I'm not talking religiously now, by the way. Many geology textbooks do believe that at one time there was one gigantic landmass, and they think that even the myth of Atlantis may come from that idea, and that the tectonic plates were separated, and that the landmasses today, which you know are in movement, they are moving a little bit, which is why the fault lines grind against each other and sometimes snap and create an earthquake. So they are moving a little bit all the time on the fluid magma that is beneath. And they feel that at one time they were all together. All right. Having said this, mountain building and all the great mechanistic powers and forces that formed our Earth at one time are not in action today. There are no new Rocky Mountains being built, thanks to God, the Creator, or we would not survive it. There are no new Atlas Mountains being formed. There's a little bit of a bubbling magmatic intrusion off the islands of Hawaii that is gradually forming a new island that eventually, in another couple thousand years or so, will emerge from the ocean. There will be another island there in the Hawaiian island chain. But that's about the extent of it. Volcanic eruptions, lava flows, cracks where magma extrudes and comes out onto the surface of the earth. But that's about it. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. That boggles your mind. It boggles my mind. The idea of bringing something into existence from nothing. Now, have you studied energy? Do you know about the laws governing falling bodies? Do you know why it is if you're on a rushing train or inside a car and you have a golf ball, you throw the golf ball up in the air, it comes right down. Instead, it goes right through the back of the car. What if it were outside and you threw it up? It would do the same thing, depending upon the wind. But it's traveled in the meantime on a parabolic arc probably 100 yards. You threw it up, and it's going along the same speed. You can read about that in encyclopedias. It will tell you exactly which law it is. Why can you stack 10,000 eggs in a truck and they don't break the ones on the bottom, and yet by this time they weigh tons? Because the distribution of the weight is equal on all their sides, which is why our skulls aren't collapsed, because of a tower of air which actually has weight that is over our heads extended up into the stratosphere. All right. The earth was without form and void. That word was is a total error. And in most King James Bibles, it has a little italics was there in italicized letters. And it means that the translators supplied that. It really should read became, because in Isaiah, I think it's 54:18, I'd have to go look that up again, don't quote me, it says that he made the earth not in tohu and bohu, but he made the earth to be inhabited. And of course, this again is not religious, quote unquote. There are any number of other textbooks that admit to that. A very wonderful book that you might want to read sometime is called The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. And they were, I think, Presbyterian, but did a fabulous job on geology and research into the causes of the flood, and absolutely proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that there was a great worldwide deluge that covered all the mountains of the earth, that it was not just a local flood. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. So the earth was covered with water. Stygian blackness. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. That is, God brooded over, or he saw this huge, big, watery planet without a single mountaintop protruding above it. And God said, let there be light. It shows in Hebrew that it's had said. It isn't that the sun was created after the earth was here with water all over it. The sun had been in existence, who knows, for how many billions, trillions, or quadrillions of billions of years. There's no way to tell. He had created the sun much earlier. But he said, let there be light. And so the Stygian blackness and the thick clouds, almost like a Venusian atmosphere, were parted, and the rays of the sun began to shine on the surface of the waters. And there was light. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. That to me means he started the earth rotating on its axis so that the light of the sun would not be reaching the part that is away from the sun, but it would be shining on the part that is bathed in sunlight. And right now it's January 2nd over there in the Micronesian Islands. It's already January 2nd over there because our sun that is now past midday is already bathing them in sunlight on the morning following their Y2K celebration. God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day. So the daylight part, approximately 12 hours at the equator, is yom in the Hebrew word, and it is day. The darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning, not the morning and the evening, but the evening and the evening first, were the first day. So God starts the days beginning at evening, because it was dark before it was light. And then it became light. And that's the way every single day he reminds us of that fact. If you'll turn to Exodus 12, 1 and 2, just to get an idea of the concept of how God uses time and continually mentions it in the Bible. Exodus 12, remember that Israel had been in captivity for generations, 400 years plus. And the Eternal spoke unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month, this monath, or this lunation, is the meaning of that word, shall be unto you the beginning of lunations, or phases of the moons. It shall be the first month of the year to you. This is the month of green ears. You've heard of Tel Aviv. Well, you know, in a lot of languages, including Spanish, they say if you're saying something with a little V in it, like verdad, they say verdad, but they say like verdad, meaning is that true? Verity, you've heard of verity. The Spanish or the Latin word for verdad is bechico, be grande. Well, bechica is the little V, be grande is the B, griega, as they say. Same thing in Hebrew. Tel Aviv means the mound, the tell of Abib. And it used to be the capital, not anymore, but it was the capital city of Israel for many, many years. Abib merely means the month of green ears. So God began regulating the months and time based upon the observation of the barley ears in the field. And sometimes spring is a little late, and sometimes spring is a little early, isn't it? Sometimes fall is a little early, sometimes winter is a little late. It isn't always a perfect model going exactly precisely according to a computer model every single year, which is why the priest went out and observed in the field the ears of barley, and if they weren't even beginning to get ripe, they would postpone because it had to do with the movement of the earth and the moon and the sun. In other words, it has to do with seasonal variations, but at the time that God pointed it out, it would have been ripe in the ears in Jerusalem, or in Palestine rather, and so God said, this month shall be the beginning of months unto you, because they were using a pagan Egyptian calendar that had no relationship whatsoever to the way God counts time. So many great events of history have taken place exactly on time. If you will turn to the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, show you an example of that. This is the lengthiest prophecy in all of the Bible, and believe it or not, some of it was written by archangels. It's not all direct quotation from God, nor from the pen of Daniel necessarily. In the 10th chapter, you see that several occasions Daniel came into contact with a great archangel and described exactly what this great creature looked like. He said in verse 6, his body was like beryl. Verse 10, and he's describing it. He doesn't say a Bessemer oven, doesn't say a slag furnace, he doesn't say a nuclear power plant, or an electric light bulb because he couldn't relate to terms other than those that were in use at his time. And so he was talking about some of the beautiful, almost translucent, precious and semi-precious stones that you could look at that looked like they gave off fire. His body was like the beryl, his face the appearance of lightning, and his eyes like lamps of fire, and his arms and feet like in color to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a huge crowd shouting. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men that were with me saw not the vision, but a great quaking fell upon them, so they fled to hide themselves. Well, he was without strength, last of verse 8, and he said he had his face toward the ground, verse 9, and verse 10, behold, an hand touched me. And he said unto me, verse 11, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto you, and stand upright, for unto you am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood there trembling. Then he said, fear not, Daniel, from the first day, time again. Daniel persevered. Daniel didn't just make one prayer and go away. Daniel kept on praying and praying and praying. From the first day that you did set your heart to understand and to chasten yourself before your God, meaning confessing his flaws and failures and mistakes and sins and asking for God's forgiveness, thy words were heard, and I am come for thy words. But the prince of Persia, of the kingdom of Persia, withstood me 21 days. 21 days. How about that? 3 solid weeks. Interesting that that period of time is put in here. 3 times 7. 7 threes. 3 sevens. 3 is finality and 7 is perfection. Perfection, completion. Complete perfection of this particular problem that had to be solved by an archangel. But lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. So who was this mighty so-called prince of the kingdom of Persia? Either a fallen angel under Satan the devil or Satan himself, probably one of Satan's, if he has top demons as opposed to lower level demons. But it was someone in the spirit world of the evil spirits that was so powerful that Michael had to come to help out Gabriel. Came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Now, why do you suppose he did that? Well, there was an alliance between Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Great. And the Medo-Persian Empire was making plans to overwhelm the Babylonian Empire. And it had to happen at a precise time because God had worked out in advance certain major events that were to take place, all of which were to coalesce at the time of the birth of John the Baptist, the begettal of Jesus Christ in the womb of Mary, the birth of Christ, the ministry of Christ, even having to do with the building of the temple prior to that time under the days of Zerubbabel. And God always caused these great world events to work out exactly as he wanted them to. So, in order to see to it that whatever this evil spirit was trying to do to wreck God's plan, and that is their aim, isn't it? That's always what they're trying to do. Destroy humankind, thwart God's program, try to wreck God's plan, try to make things happen in chaotic disarray instead of orderly sequence. And so here's an archangel helping another archangel. I remain there with the kings of Persia. Now I am come to make you understand what shall befall your people in the latter days. For the vision is for many days. What are we dealing with here? Time. The latter days. The last time. The end time. And the vision is for many days from now. It's for way out in the future. He said he became like he was dumb. And behold, one in verse 16, like the sons of men, touched my lips and I opened my mouth and spake. He said, O my Lord, by the vision of my sorrows, it turned upon me and I retained no strength. How can the servant of this, my Lord, talk with this, my Lord? Look how totally humble and almost fearful he was of this great being. As for me, straightway there remained no strength in me, neither is there breath left in me. Take my breath away. There came again one that like a man, looked like a man. Didn't look like a funny little girl with a dress and a halo and little wings. It looked like a man. And he strengthened me. And he said, O man greatly beloved. Wouldn't that be fabulous to hear that from someone right next to God's throne? Comes down and says, actually touches Daniel, holds him on the shoulder. Be strengthened, O man greatly beloved. Peace be unto you. Fear not. Be strong. Yea, be strong. And when he had spoken unto me, I was strengthened. and said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. And he said, Do you know wherefore I come unto you? And now I will return to fight with the prince of Persia. We don't know. The news doesn't report this kind of thing, do they? Can you think of any times that in recent memory, let's say, in this last century, when there were certain great events that took place where you might suspect that God had a hand? And I'm not talking about what you think might have been a part of the Church of God. Not talking about religion at all. I'm talking about the world. I've been accused of preaching headline religion, you know, and so on. Well, the headlines such as these, had they been written, and they probably were in Babylonian cuneiform, when a great empire is thrown down to the ground and absolutely pillaged and destroyed by another great empire that goes to the work of having the siege engines set up so that the people who could not bear news to those inside the beleaguered city of Babylon from about 120 miles upstream, and so that months could go by while vast armies were digging another channel so they could actually at some time divert the course of the river into a huge area and let a giant lake form, dry up the river, and while Belshazzar, in a drunken orgy like celebration of their New Year's, and all the rest of them are drunk and asleep, a whole Persian army walks underneath the river gate into the city of Babylon, which was absolutely impenetrable, a fortress like the world has never seen before. The walls were so wide that a six-horse chariot could make a running turn at its corner. It was a gigantic structure. But they walked underneath the river gate dry-shod and were inside the city and took it, and it fell in about October of 538 B.C., exactly as God had decided it was going to do. Do you think that God Almighty might have provided a man on the scene called Winston Churchill? Do you think that God might have caused Adolf Hitler, out of vanity and the stupidity of the blunder that he pulled at Dunkirk when he was approached by Goering, who said, Let my Luftwaffe take care of the British Expeditionary Force. All right. And so Hitler stopped the Panzer divisions. And the British, the whole British army, was absolutely defenseless. They'd left all their equipment. They arrived back in England only with small arms. And if Roosevelt had not emptied, contrary to Congress and contrary to the law, armories, including in Tyler, Texas and Springfield, Oregon, of every rifle and every little machine gun, even handguns that we could get our hands on, ship them through Canada and get them to England, Churchill told Roosevelt, we're stripped to the bone. We've got people out here with nothing but wooden pitchforks. We've got no arms left. Do you think Hitler's blunders were caused? I think there was something to that. The chance bomb that lit at Peenemünde, right in the middle of the works when Hitler was about to develop an atomic bomb. The blunders in the Battle of the Bulge, the blunders in some of the great wars, great battles during the Great War of World War II. I believe Almighty God was pulling some strings, and he was tweaking some events there. He was intervening. He was causing an archangel to come and put a thought in some general's mind. I think George Patton was used of God. That's why we're not speaking German here today. That's why our children aren't growing up in slavery, because these people were there, and they did what they did. They weren't religious people, but God used them. Because God has a purpose. He has a program and a plan. And it was not in God's purpose to let the United States be overwhelmed. The fall of Babylon, the rise of the Persian Empire, Alexander the Great, his death, and the fight and the squabble between the four generals before his body was even interred so that it broke up into the Seleucidae and the Ptolemies of Egypt, the rise of Rome, the collapse of Rome in 476, the revival of Rome in 554 under General Belisarius. Every bit of that, the deadly wound that was healed, great empires, Daniel prophesied of every single one of them. It would be just like saying a modern prophet would have come along and said, Britain shall reign supreme in the 17th and 18th century. In the early 19th century, the United States will begin the ascendancy. In the middle of that century, they will develop a great war. After that war, there will be a protracted 50-year Cold War, a great arms race between Russia and the United States. None of that was prophesied. But events equally that great were prophesied, and every one of them took place exactly when God wanted them to happen. Here we see a little glimpse into the way God deals, not through a church organization always, because Daniel had nothing to do with the struggle between Michael and Gabriel and the prince of the kingdom of Persia, did he? He was just being informed that it was going on. So every time you think of one of these people that we've been talking about trying to take prophecy and God's word into their own hands and go out and shoot it out with the Israeli police as if they're going to bring some great event to pass, like Armageddon, for pity's sake, it just is so ludicrous that you can't believe what you're reading. Chapter 11, verse 1. Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, the Medo-Persian Empire was an alliance between the Medes and the Persians. Even I stood to confirm and strengthen him. If that had not happened, the alliance would have fallen apart. The Persian Empire would not have overthrown Babylon, and world history would not have come about as it has. Sometimes people deal with, like it was a movie, for example, one time where they were aboard an aircraft carrier, and they sailed through some time warp, and the idea was all of a sudden a modern American nuclear aircraft carrier with fighting Hornets and I guess Tomcats, F-14s aboard, was suddenly seeing Japanese Zeros in World War II. And while there were a few lives lost and some senator rescued and put ashore on an island, some of his crew were killed and this and that, they had to deal with the idea, well, we can't intervene because the whole of history would change. But the dog and some other people, it was, I think Kirk Douglas was in that. I saw it on HBO at home when it came around. A fascinating story, of course. It's just purely fanciful. People have always wondered about time warps, about going back. There was one, I forget that whole series where they were doing that and some stupid car would take off and would land back in the 50s and a guy would meet his own mother on the dance floor. But anyway, I've speculated, you know, you've done that too, I'm sure. As a boy, especially as a young kid, you have a lot of fanciful ideas about what if I had been a swashbuckling sailor down in the Caribbean, you know, with Henry and some of the rest of them back there, Black Bart, whoever he might have been. All right. I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him, and now I will show you the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion, that's Alexander, and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken. It was. He died at age about 31, crying at the gates of Hercules because there was no more world to conquer. Unbelievable story when you read about his life. And shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. It was. Laomedon in Syria. Ptolemy Soter in Egypt. And Antiochus Epiphanes, I believe. And then over in Rome, I've forgotten the name of that man, but there were four empires that actually came about as a result of the death of Alexander. And this was many, many, many years previous. That's why in one place in the book of Isaiah, God mentions the name of Cyrus and said that he had named him even before he was born by about 400 years. Now turn to the first chapter of the book of Luke. And here again is something that has to do with a particular period of time. And God's plan being worked out according to events and according to God's time schedule, not man's and not would-be prophets and wild-eyed weirdos that get all kinds of weird scenarios based upon a flawed pagan Roman calendar, which doesn't mean anything. Our weeks are pagan. The days of the week are pagan named. The weekly cycle is the only thing that has been retained that is really of God, because one whole nation has never forgotten what day it was all at once. In the first chapter of Luke, notice in the first verse, "Forasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a declaration of those things which most surely believed among us, even as they delivered them unto us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses," Matthew, Mark, and of course John, along with Luke, "it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first," relative to time, from the beginning of that period, "to write unto thee in order," not write unto thee so that, but write unto thee in order. Notice in the first verse he said, "others have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration." That's why Luke is not called, that Luke is one of the synoptic gospels and John is not, because John's is not in the same order. That's why you need a harmony of the gospel sometime to see how some of them are out of sequence. They report an event depending upon the importance of it and how they viewed it, not necessarily all in exactly the same order. But Luke's is in order, that you might know the certainty of those things wherein you've been instructed. There was in the days of Herod, and that's very important because they have lost sight of that, and they have, therefore, that's why they don't know that Christ was actually born in 4 BC, and that he was probably born somewhere in the 27th, 28th, 29th, whenever it was that year, I've forgotten now, the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles. And if you extrapolate backwards, you can come up with what I think Dr. Bullinger is quite correct in assuming, that is that possibly on December 25th, in the previous year, Christ was conceived. Now that won't hold true every year, will it? Because God's holy days fluctuate and vary through the seasons, and December 25th is a fixed date. So we're not saying that that's true every single year. We're saying that at the time of these events, it is quite likely that Lady Day, which they later on began to observe in, adoration of Mary and the Annunciation of Mary, was at the time of the conception. And that's proved by his very lengthy article about the course of Abia. It's about 4 pages in length, and I think about appendix 127, don't quote me, it might be 197 anyway, it's in the appendices of Bullinger's Companion Bible. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the course of Abia. And they had 2 weeks, and they had to serve twice in the year. And that course of Abia is referred to back in 1 Chronicles 24:10 and verse 19, as are all the other courses of the priests. And his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. And they had no child, because that Elizabeth was barren. And they both were now well stricken in years. It came to pass that while he executed the priest's office before God in the order of his course, and that was very timely, according to the custom of the priest's office, his lot was to burn incense when he went into the temple of the Lord. The whole multitude of the people were praying without at the time of incense. Formal worship was in vogue then. And there were certain times when the prayers were like incense going up and the people would pray in public. And we have nothing like that today. And of course, once the temple was destroyed and the Levitical priesthood no longer stood or was in effect, that did not take place during the days of the disciples following the resurrection of Christ. There appeared unto him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And when Zechariah saw him, he was troubled and fear fell upon him. Well, of course, suddenly, boom, you know, pop right out of thin air. And there is an angel. But the angel said unto him, Fear not, Zacharias, for your prayer is heard. But they had been praying for a long time, for years, so that they were now quite elderly, and they'd wanted a child for many, many years. Finally, the angel says, Your prayer is heard. Your wife, Elizabeth, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name John. And you shall have joy and gladness, and many shall rejoice at his birth. For he shall be great in the sight of the Lord, and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink, like the Nazarite vow. And he shall be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. Completely unique. No one else like John in all the history of the world. And many of the children of Israel shall he turn to the Lord their God. And he shall go before him in the spirit and the power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just. And as Christ said later on, if you will hear it, if you will receive it, Elijah has already come. And there are people to this day that want to make a man into Elijah, some man of this day, or some people thought my father was. Well, then by some sort of weird reasoning, what am I supposed to be, Elisha? But I don't have a mantle. I can't resurrect anyone. I can't put my fingers in the ears and cause the ears of my two deaf sons to open up. But Elisha was a prophet who had immense power, and God performed great miracles through him. No, Elijah has already come. John the Baptist fulfilled that prophecy. It's not going to be fulfilled twice. He wasn't a shadowy type. He was the fulfillment. And the angel said so, and Christ said so. So I'm going to believe what the angel said and what Christ said. To make ready a people prepared for the Lord. And Zacharias said unto the angel, Whereby shall I know this? For I'm an old man, and my wife is well stricken in years. And he said that he was going to be dumb and not be able to speak, because, verse 20, because you believe not my words, which shall be fulfilled in their season, when it was exactly time. The birth of Jesus Christ was not happenstance. The fact that we're not told to celebrate the birth doesn't mean that we cannot come into a very, very likely window, shall we say, of when he might have been born. But we're not told to celebrate his birth date. The Bible conceals that. It takes a lot of scholarship to try to ferret that out. And I think that Dr. Bullinger has done just exactly that. Notice Matthew 1, 16 and 17. You know, Matthew is a genealogical table. And it says, Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. And from David until the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations. And from the carrying away into Babylon unto Christ are 14 generations. 2 times 7, 3 times 14. Everything on time. The building of the temple, the beginning of the ministry of John the Baptist, the begettal of Jesus Christ, the birth of Jesus Christ, the death of Christ, the exact period of time that he would be in the tomb, is absolutely essential to recognizing who is the true Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And that is the one sign that all of the so-called professing world has rejected. And now the so-called parent church, and as I said time again, no parent of mine, but has also rejected that. And I've understood that people begin to mumble around about Good Friday and Easter Sunday morning, and trying to tell people that have studied that and have known that, Matthew 12:40, over and over again. I'll read that, Matthew 12:39. He answered and said unto them, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, but there shall no sign be given to it but the sign of the prophet Jonas. And Jonah is a book written in Hebrew, not Greek, idiomatic expressions. For as Jonas was 3 days, we read in Genesis 1 that the first nighttime part of the day was dark, and the daylight part of the day was day. So we know that each is 12 hours. The Hebrew word yom means the daylight part. And the Greek equivalent's exactly the same, which is why he doesn't make the mistake of saying 3 days and leave it at that. He says 3 days and three nights, doesn't he? Not just 3 days, so they can't play around with it, make it part of a day. And three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And if they reject that sign, they reject Jesus Christ. They can use his name all they want. Oh, praise you, Lord. They can do all they want to, but if they reject that sign, they reject the true Jesus Christ of Nazareth, the only sign he ever left. And there are tremendous chronological proofs to demonstrate exactly all of these events and how they coalesce into the dates, into the exact events that Jesus Christ had determined were going to happen. How many times do we see times, times, and half a time mentioned in the Bible? In the 11th chapter of the book of Revelation, for example, and we know that there's a 3 1/2 year period coming during which there is going to be tribulation, heavenly signs, and day of the Lord. It says in the 11th chapter that he was to measure the temple of God, the altar, and them that worship, but the court, verse 2, leave out. It is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. In Daniel 11:40-45, you read how the great northern power comes into Palestine, occupies the Holy Land, as it's called today, but it's called Sodom and Egypt in the book of Revelation, right here in this chapter, and that the land of Egypt shall not escape, and that they are in Jerusalem, and they occupy it. Well, they are Gentiles. Now, I was asked the other day, and I had to answer a letter, who are the Gentiles? The word Gentile is merely goyim in Hebrew, and all it means is someone other than a Hebrew. It merely was a term that meant all the races, irrespective of color, of all of the earth that were not Hebrew. I don't say Jewish, Hebrew. Eber was way back before Abraham, the grandfather of Abraham. There was never a Jew until Judah, and his name later on became shortened to a nickname like Jew. In the first place, it's mentioned in 2 Kings 16:6 when the Jews are at war against Israel. So Gentiles, that's anybody and everybody who is not a member of one of the 12, actually 13, if you look at the two tribes of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, the tribes of Israel. And that's all it means. It doesn't mean pagan, doesn't mean heathen. It is not a disrespectful or an evil term. It merely means the nations. And some translations of the Bible actually have it that way. Instead of Gentiles, they will have the nations. They referred to the foreigners, the other nations around them, but not a part of their race. So it is to be trodden underfoot 42 months, 3.5 years. But you see, a prophetic month is exactly 30 days. And there are 12 months of 30 days in these prophetic years. He's not using a solar calendar or the defective calendar of today, but he's using now a prophetic month. And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days. I think he does that. I think the Bible does that so that you know that time times and half a time, and that 42 months, and that 1,603 days are clothed in sackcloth, that is, 1,203 days, are all the same period of time. He does that to make sure you know that's exactly the same period of time. And these are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth. If any man will hurt them, fire proceeds out of their mouth. I don't think it means like a blowtorch. I think it means a command, like divine fiat, and then it is symbolic or metaphorical, and some plague falls. If a man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. These have power to shut heaven, that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, and have power over waters to turn them to blood and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will. And there's a type in this of Moses and Aaron. All of Israel by this time will have been subjugated. The United States will be completely subjugated. Britain and all of its commonwealth will be subjugated. The democracies of Northwestern Europe that will be occupied by that time, and probably some of them will not go along eventually with the beast power that will come out of the ashes of the present EU and out of a global economic crunch and a rise of despots and dictators. And I do not think that Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, perhaps Holland are going to be a part of it. I know that Britain is going head to head against Gerhard Schroeder, Tony Blair, right now over the tax impositions that the EU is trying to impose upon Britain and try to prevent investors in England from, well, actually trying to tax them heavily from investing in the European stock market and in the euro. But I said that back in the 50s, in 1955, 57, 58, 59. I was saying I do not believe Great Britain will be a part of that 10-nation group because Britain is, I believe, the Ephraim of biblical prophecy, and I think we'll live to see that come true. When they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit, again a figurative statement, shall make war against them and overcome them and kill them. Until that time, they're supernaturally protected of God. And their dead bodies, and it's not the Old and the New Testament. Can you believe anybody reading this would tell you that the two witnesses are the Old Testament and the New Testament? There are people with the dumbest ideas. And now people are looking around and they see the different leaders of these breakaway groups. Could it be him? Could it be him? Could it be him? Who cares? God knows. And when it comes God's time, he will give great spiritual power and courage and ability to those two men. And it seems to be that it will only be at a time when there will be no more organized preaching of the gospel, as we are doing now over television and through the internet and our publications and so on. But that will not be allowed. Then it will be up close, face to face, in your face, and personal. And that's the way it was with Moses and Aaron. They didn't write little booklets and have somebody deliver them to some of the Egyptians so that a gradual group of the Egyptians got word that the Israelites needed to be let out of there. They just marched into the palace and said, if you don't let them go, then all your cattle are going to suffer a murrain like boils, and they're all going to die. And it's going to happen according to my word. And that's what Moses said the very first plague. When he strode out of the audience of Pharaoh, he said, right tomorrow at this time, according to my word. And there came the plague, boom, right on time, as Moses had said it was going to. Now here are the two witnesses that will go before the beast and the false prophet, who will be occupying Jerusalem and saying once again, let my people go. And if you don't, here's what's going to happen. And places all over the world are going to be affected by these great, powerful plagues that they will have the power to command. They're going to be killed. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of that great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt. I'll go with that. I've been there. Filthy city. Absolutely filthy city. That old city, it is unbelievable. And talk about being trodden down of the Gentiles. You go to the old city, it's been trodden down of the Gentiles, of the Arabs, and so on, from time immemorial. and is a very fetid, stinking place in so many ways, where also our Lord was crucified. And they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3 days and a half. Why? A microcosm of the 3 1/2 years. While God's church, God's work, God's prophecies, God's witness lies dead in the streets. As the church as a whole and its work will lie inert for 3 1/2 years, and no voice, no power, no witness, no broadcast, no television program, no personal evangelism, no publications, nothing being done. So the two prophets will lie there decaying, although it takes 4 days to start that process, but lie there in the streets with the video cams and the satellites showing pictures of them all over the world. It says, they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them and make merry and send gifts to one another. We finally got rid of them because these two prophets tormented them that dwell on the earth. And after 3 days and a half, the Spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them which saw them. I should imagine a resurrection of the very people that they had heard this powerful witness over and over and over again tell them exactly what they were doing, and that they needed to repent and let these people go, the Americans and the British and all the rest of them. They wouldn't do it. And I heard a great voice from heaven saying unto them, come up hither. They didn't go to the third heaven. They ascended up to heaven in the heavens, in the air, the atmosphere, in a cloud. And it was so close that their enemies beheld them. And you can't even see an individual in an airplane at 30-some thousand feet. You can barely see the airplane. So they're only up there 1,000 or 2,000 feet or so, and they're probably glowing with a bright light, and they're absolutely turned into a spirit being, and the people down below are able to see them, and that's what this prophecy is saying. And the same hour, the earth begins to reel and rumble, a great earthquake. It destroys 10% of the city, and 7,000 men were killed, and the remnant were affrighted and gave glory to the God of heaven, those that were still able. The second woe is past, and behold, the third woe comes quickly, and that woe consists of seven last plagues, and at the seventh of those plagues, second coming of Jesus Christ occurs. You know, we continually talk about time, and God is a creator of time. I said earlier that time and distance are the same thing, and I don't think I explained in detail. I'll do it very, very quickly before coming to something on another part of this subject, and that is that all material things are just so much energy compacted into law-abiding forms. As you know from your school, the smallest divisible particle of matter retaining the properties from which it came, so it's a molecule of iron, or it's a molecule of leather, or a molecule of some stone or another, is a molecule. And its molecular structure has to do with the very various kinds of atoms. Some molecules have thousands of atoms, some only have three, like water, H2O, etc. So then when they discovered through Madame Curie's investigations, and eventually came to understand a little about atomic energy, they came to understand that all matter is merely energy and reduced to its tiniest particles, like the particles inside of an atom, that each atom is like a miniature universe that has a nucleus and negatively and positively charged electrons, protons, and neutrons that are neutral in between, and that they apparently are whizzing and whirling about in a 1/1,000,000,000th of a second, however they try to define it. They've never even seen it. They can just tell it through their experimentation. So I can be converted into energy by a process called nuclear fission or fusion. My body can literally be converted into the energy that is compacted into this physical form and kept alive by air, food, and water. So can, and you don't doubt this, so can this podium, can't it? Chop it up and stick it in your fireplace, you can carry it out in your hands later on. You can convert it into heat, light, gas, and ash. The same thing can be done to me. They carry me home, put me on a mantle in a little urn, there's Grandpa, right? Right, don't ever doubt it. So it's a simple principle, but it's just amazing to me how people take life for granted, and the purpose of life for granted, and the length of life for granted, and they don't look up to the Maker who put them here and gave them that life, and give Him the glory and the tremendous awe that they owe Him. There's a great deal more, and I want to turn to all of them, but just 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 to 8, I won't read it all. It says, "Of the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you. For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord comes as a thief in the night." What are we dealing with here? The day of the Lord is a whole time of the Lord, and I think it lasts for a year. A day is a year, the way God looked at it when the spies searched out Israel. And he says so in Numbers 14:34. And I think since 2.5 years is the time in which Israel is going to be in the worst of the tribulation, it says that he will eventually lift them up in the book of Hosea. And it seems to be when it says after 2 days, in the third day he will lift us up, that it implies that in the day of the Lord, once the great plagues are falling, that things get a little bit easier for those people in captivity. And there's one more year to endure before the second coming of Christ. Verse 4, "Ye brethren are not in darkness that day should overtake you as a thief." In 2 Thessalonians 2, 1-6, he said, "We beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letters from us, that the day of Christ," the time of Christ's intervention, "is at hand." I think it takes place during a day. It talks about him coming as the sun shining in his strength. And it says, "As the lightning shineth out of the east unto the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be." Now, the word there is not lightning, L-I-G-H-T-N-I-N-G, like a sudden burst of energy as in a thunderstorm. It is lightening, and the only lightening or brightening that you know of that shines from the east unto the west is the sun as the earth rotates. Therefore, as he is coming, nearing the earth, just like in this business of watching from all the way down around the Micronesian islands as each nation up to New Zealand and Australia and coming around to Beijing, China, and so on, yesterday afternoon, as a lot of you were watching, I assume. So that same event, the same kind of a thing is going to happen. He will be coming to the earth, and the earth is still rotating. And as it rotates on its axis during the span of one day, Christ is coming to this earth. And all people are going to understand that it's a gigantic phenomenon. He's at the head of countless millions of angels and is going to conquer this earth and rule it with a rod of iron for 1,000 years. And that'll be the beginning of the real new millennium. All of this frenetic celebration is because people just want an excuse for a party. Some people are going to do it again next year, but I'll bet you it'll be a little bitty fizzle because of the... Can you imagine the British spent $1 billion on fireworks alone? And if you include the Ferris wheel and the big dome that I've written about in the past, and apparently they changed their mind and didn't put that big seated figure in there, we couldn't see it anywhere, but all their website said that way back a year and a half or so ago that was going to be a big figure in there, but I didn't see it. But they spent on the Ferris wheel that won't work and the dome and all of that $3 billion, but they took it out of their national lottery, so the people really paid for it. Amazing. All just to have a party. Whoopee. Happy New Year. Hand me the Excedrin. Something about time. They say tomorrow never comes. And I found a very inspiring little poem on the internet that was sent to me by a friend this morning that I think I'll share with you. Tomorrow never comes because tomorrow can't be today. Today is today, and yesterday is yesterday. Yesterday never catches up. Tomorrow never comes. We always live today. Well, there have been lots of poems and lots of statements about spend this day as if it is the first day of the rest of your life, which in fact it is. Spend this Sabbath like it's the last Sabbath until the next Sabbath, which of course it is. We're always marking special red letter moments. We're planning for certain things in the future. We're looking toward dates and times. And God says, don't do that, for you know not what shall take place on the morrow. But say, if the Lord will, we shall go here and go there and do such and such. So I always try to say in my letters, announcing like I did to the people in Knoxville on I think the 27th of this month, 29th of this month on the Sabbath, that God willing, we will be in Knoxville to speak to you at that time. Since tomorrow never comes, I'd like to share this with you. If tomorrow never comes, I knew it would be the last time that I'd see you fall asleep. If I knew that, I would tuck you in more tightly and pray the Lord your life to keep. If I knew it would be the last time that I see you walk out of the door, I would give you a hug and kiss and call you back for one more. If I knew it would be the last time I'd hear your voice lifted up in praise, I would videotape each action and word so I could play them back day after day. If I knew it would be the last time I could spare an extra minute or two to stop and say, I love you, instead of assuming that you know I do. If I knew it would be the last time I would be there to share your day. Well, I'm sure you'll have so many more, so I can just let this one slip away. For surely there's always tomorrow to make up for an oversight, and we always get a second chance to make everything right. There will always be another day to say our I love yous, and certainly there's another chance to say anything that I can do. But just in case I could be wrong, and today is all I get, I'd like to say how much I love you and hope that we never forget. Tomorrow is not really promised to anyone, young or old alike, and today may be the last chance you ever get to hold your loved one tight. So if you're waiting for tomorrow, why not do it today? For if tomorrow never comes, you'll surely regret the day that you didn't take that extra time for a smile, a hug, or a kiss, and you were too busy to grant someone what turned out to be their one last wish. So hold your loved ones close today, whisper in their ear, and tell them how much you love them and that you'll always hold them dear. Take time to say, I'm sorry, and please forgive me, thank you, or it's okay. And if tomorrow never comes, you'll have no regrets about today.